Gutflix is the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover curated GI content on IBD, hepatology, endoscopy, and more, as well as expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts personalized to your clinical interests. Start exploring at gutflix.eu. Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG podcast. I'm Pradeep Mundre. I'm a gastroenterologist from the UK, and I'm one of the co-hosts for the UEG podcast. This is not the usual episode. Here, we are covering the highlights and the very best of IBD during the recently concluded UEG week in Berlin, which is definitely my favorite international conference. I'm sure it is for all of you. Those of you who were there and some of you who were not there, IBD once again seemed to dominate this year's UEG, not just with a scientific program, but also with massive industry stands by the mere physical presence. As we move further and further away from the world of thiopurines and anti-TNFs, which seem to be certainly my favorite drugs in IBD, to a totally new world of IBD therapy, we seem to be flooded with limitless choice. Now, whilst choice is important, and one would think that more choices will make decisions easier, but having a choice overload is making us much harder for either healthcare professionals to make decisions on treatment. And more importantly, it's even more confusing if we allow our patients to make choice on these drugs. I think this is more important as most of the advanced IBD therapy sit similar in terms of efficacy. In the last couple of podcasts that I did on this topic, Best of IBD with Tim Raine and Aristotan, a couple of drugs seems to stand out in the last 2 years. And I guess what we want now is probably not new drugs, but we want drugs that stand out from the rest of the lot, or maybe some sort of advancement in the targeted treatment with either a molecular or genetic or phenotypic markers that would aid in targeted treatment to improve efficacy. During the 4 days at Berlin, there was some exciting new science was presented, and I was gutted that I couldn't attend many of those, but we have our very special guest today to debrief us on the very best of IBD from the UEG week. Now, I'd like to welcome Dr. Clarthe Bell-Cogg, who is a gastroenterologist and IBD specialist at Barts and the Royal London Hospital. Bell was also the UEG Education Committee e-learning team and is a faculty at the UEG Summer School and is one of the authors of the recently published British Society guidelines on IBD. Welcome to UEG Podcast, Bell.
Thank you very much, Pradeep. It's really great, as always, to be part of anything UEG related. It's very nice to be here today to talk about some of the IBD highlights from what was indeed another strong UEG week. I'm not sure how much easier I will make it for you or other listeners with regards to treatment choice or other decisions, but certainly lots of interesting data to discuss.
Lovely. So, Bell, let's start with the obvious, probably, you know, the most groundbreaking science that was published. And why do you think that's important?
Yeah, I think one of the most groundbreaking studies presented in the plenary opening session was presented by Mette Hjulsgaard. It looked at pregnancy and infant outcomes following the use of JAK inhibitors in pregnant women with IBD. And this really stood out because JAK inhibitors are considered unsafe in pregnancy. That's due to their ability to cross the placenta from early pregnancy. And that raises then a concern, but it's based mainly on animal data. There no data in humans. And this was a real-world study from 22 centers, contributing patients across 15 countries. So they had 55 pregnancies, women exposed to all three JAK inhibitors, so Tova, UPA, and filgotinib. And importantly, this was not only early in pregnancy. 39 women were treated with JAK inhibitors throughout the whole pregnancy. And the results were surprisingly reassuring in that maternal complications were low, there were no congenital abnormalities, Early development was normal, vaccine responses among the neonatals normal. And so an important conclusion from the authors was that, okay, of course, it should not be used regularly. It should very much be reserved for situations where there are no other viable treatment options. And if it is used, it should definitely be with caution through very shared cautious decision making. But it does finally give us some real world insights to inform those very difficult decisions that some women with IBD face.
So, Bill, how would this knowledge help you with your current practice? Or how would you change what you do currently?
Yeah, so I don't think it changes our standard guidance that we say it's not a drug for pregnancy. We will stop the JAK inhibitors 4 weeks before a woman tries to conceive. We inform women that this is not a drug for in pregnancy. However, there will be a small, very small subset of women that are very sick and for whom a JAK inhibitor is the only drug, and they may choose to use it or continue it. And if they ask me, what is the data? I now have something to discuss with them.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Belle. Now, was there something in Berlin that sort of surprised you during the UG week, which kind of goes against the popular belief so far that we have on IBD? I guess this is probably one of them, but maybe there's something else.
This was one of them, yeah. Yeah, so I think another study to highlight would be the CURE study, which was presented by the JetAid group. Maybe it's not entirely unexpected, but we certainly probably had hoped for different results. So, you know, we recently had a profile study that showed that the top-down approach in early Crohn's can really dramatically improve outcomes. And this study then took it a step further and asked, could we actually cure Crohn's disease? Meaning they studied patients with very early Crohn's disease. They were treated with adalimumab. And then when they reached deep remission, adalimumab was stopped to see if the patients then remained flare-free. So i.e. if they could manage their Crohn's after that without adalimumab. And unfortunately, the answer was no. So stopping therapy was not successful for these patients. So we are not yet at a point where we can have durable remission of treatment for our patients with Crohn's disease.
Okay, so let me summarize that. These are Crohn's patients, new diagnosis. They were treated with deep remission and the drug was stopped and that didn't lead on to sustained remission. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Well, there were a couple of surprising things. So after 1 year, only 22% of patients achieved deep remission, and this was endoscopic remission. But if then adalimumab was stopped, only a quarter of patients were still in remission. So a second year on, only 4% of the total cohort were in deep remission.
Okay, that's great. And was there any new science that was presented and that would change our current clinical practice straight away? Maybe give us confidence to help us with our current practice?
I think something that is quite achievable, it will require some learning maybe, but it's very achievable for everyone, is monitoring our patients with IBD differently. And in general, we're now slowly moving away from solely relying on endoscopy for the routine monitoring of disease activity. I'm sure you know there's been a huge and growing interest in intestinal ultrasound for this purpose. Endoscopy, it's invasive, expensive, not very user-friendly or end-user-friendly. In contrast, ultrasound is non-invasive, cheap, and patients love it. And there's now a good evidence base for using intestinal ultrasound for IBD disease monitoring. There was a whole session at UEG that included several studies on this. So there were two studies that looked at ways that we could also assess rectal inflammation. It's very easy with ultrasound to see inflammation in the whole colon. The rectum is not well visualized. It's behind the bladder. One study showed that you can use a transperineal ultrasound technique to quite accurately assess rectal inflammation. Another study showed that also just transabdominal ultrasound can do it quite well. So we're probably able to do this better and better. And then other studies showed that you can predict with ultrasound quite early on if a patient is going to respond to filgotinib. And a final study showed that in vedolizumab, you can get in Crohn's disease, you can achieve transmural healing. So it highlights the increasing role for ultrasound for us in IBD monitoring. I've got a question for you, though. We will never stop entirely doing endoscopy. You're an endoscopist. And I think it will be more and more therapeutic. There was a study also on endoscopic stricture treatment. I don't know if you saw the study. So this was the best CD trial. So what they did, they compared endoscopic techniques for the treatment of short strictures in Crohn's disease, either using endoscopic balloon dilatation or an endoscopic stricturotomy. And it showed that the endoscopic stricturotomy had less clinical recurrence of strictures.
So I'm just trying to think how stricturotomy is done, probably using a knife and cutting the little stricture. It seems to work better for even the upper GI tract for whatever reason. I guess the balloon is a bit blind and crude, whereas stricturotomy is more precise. So I can imagine that it would work better compared to balloon. I need to look at the study and what they did, what the technical details of that. So that's a good one to highlight. Thanks, Belle.
Yeah, so these were some interim data. So I think in upcoming conferences, we'll hear more about that.
Yeah, good. Now, a lot of our centers don't have interstitial ultrasound. How do we go about, I guess we need training. I'm assuming gastroenterologists are best placed in taking this on rather than our radiologists for interstitial ultrasound. How do we go about getting training? You aware of anywhere where people can get trained?
Yeah, so IBUS is an international organization for intestinal ultrasound. They provide a framework on how to do this. So they have got some teaching modules and they have some guidance on how you should be trained and competencies that people should achieve. I guess you can more or less compare them with what JAG offers for endoscopy. So that would be a good starting point to have a look. Yes, certainly it's the IBD physicians that should be doing the ultrasound.
Yeah, yeah. As long as they're not biased, as long as their assessment is objective.
Of course, of course. Yeah. So, and this is again what IBUS does. It offers a real structured framework for recording the findings. Yeah.
Lovely. That's great. So that's the way to go. I think more and more, certainly up north, at least in my center, we don't do. And I'm not too sure in the neighboring hospitals, I'm not aware, at least the centers we trained. So that's the way to go. And more people vouch on this as we go along. Thanks for that. Is there any new knowledge that would change how we use our current existing treatments, either in the realms of safety or any long-term data that was highlighted at the meeting?
I think it's nice to see more data about the IL-23 inhibitors. We now have three drugs available, risankizumab, mirikizumab, and now also guselkumab. And we show some data about the durability of risankizumab in Crohn's disease from long-term open label extension. We see that risankizumab remains very effective and also remains very safe. This was studied in patients having been treated with risankizumab up to 4 years. And then there were also extra data on guselkumab. What do we do when patients have been on ustekinumab? You know, this targets both IL-12 and IL-23. And they presented was the GALAXY long-term extension. And it showed that if patients had either non-response or loss of response to ustekinumab, they could still have a good response to guselkumab.
Those are the new drugs, which I'm just starting to be aware of. I'm surprised there's four-year data for these things.
Yeah, I know. It takes a while before NICE approves it, but it should be on your formulary soon, I hope.
Okay. And these drugs, I know risankizumab, guselkumab, that's available everywhere, generally in Europe?
Yeah. So it's licensed for the use both in ulcerative colitis and in Crohn's disease. And NICE has also approved it.
Okay.
So it should now everywhere be implemented. I don't know if the home care companies in England can deliver it yet, but it should be very close.
Excellent. Okay. The next one is close to me. Not that I see a lot of IBD patients, but the ones I diagnosed always ask me about the etiology. And deep within, somehow I feel IBD is almost like a symptom of the primary disease, which is lifestyle or something or the other. We don't know whether it's genetic or the environmental factors, but lifestyle, I feel it's a lifestyle disease. But maybe what are your thoughts on this? And was there anything that was presented? Because that's so important, I think, because we seem to be coming up with so many new drugs, but we never seem to go anywhere close to finding out an etiology.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's really important. Environmental factors, including lifestyle and diet, play a huge role. Last year, some data were presented from there are more and more studies that are presented that show us that with diet modifications, Crohn's disease in particular can be modified. There was not that much on that in this conference. We do not know the single cause for IBD because there isn't one. IBD is a spectrum of diseases, and it's not only those environmental factors. They only then push IBD in someone that's genetically predisposed. And I think the more and more we understand genetics, it allows us to understand the disease biology and maybe have further therapeutic targets. So there was one study that looked at very early onset IBD, because it gives a real window for understanding IBD disease, because those very young people often have a single gene defect. This was a study in a family that had an epithelial barrier gene defect, highlighting the role of the epithelial barrier in developing inflammatory bowel disease. And there was a Finnish study that showed that if a certain gene variant is predictive of greater need for aggressive advanced therapy, So providing potentially precision medicines or a tool of identifying patients that need more aggressive treatment. And then people are also starting to do now single cell RNA sequencing studies to sort of map on the single cell RNA analysis data and then linking it with response to specific medications. Because this is, of course, a big question for us, is which drug will work in which patient. They did not really have that answer yet, but it was a really elegant study. It was presented by Britta Siegmund, big collaboration. They're starting to build an atlas that then provides a resource for researchers to move again towards personalized treatment plans.
Thanks, Bell. Thanks for highlighting that. The next discussion point, which I really wanted to avoid, something about highlighting any new drugs. I was wondering if there are any new drugs. We really didn't want to discuss this. As long as they have names, we can discuss. We don't want letters and numbers. Was there anything exciting for the specialists like you?
Yeah, I can give you real names.
Okay, good.
And I can be very brief. They've been on the horizon now for a little while, and more data on them, promising data on these drugs have been presented. One is called obefazimod. It's a tablet that enhances the expression of a little microRNA that in turn reduces inflammation. So a whole new mechanism of action. That's obefazimod, and further efficacy and safety data on this drug were presented. And the second new target is TL1A. So this is a protein that's involved in both inflammation and fibrosis. And there's a new monoclonal antibody that's called tulisokibart that shows promising data for the use of ulcerative colitis was presented on this study. So yes, obefazimod and tulisokibart.
And do they stand out at all, or are they similar, or are we very early to say that?
I think that obefazimod shows promising data, and tulis in particular. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. Is there anything else that you wanted to highlight?
No, it's just as I was thinking back about the conference in preparation for talking to you today, it was just so nice to see so many European and global collaborations. I think the IBD world, and I think in general, is very collaborative. And that's really nice to see in the current climate with lots of diverse presenters. So I think, yeah, there's lots of hope for the IBD community and for our patients.
That's great. First of all, really like to thank you for taking time today on Friday afternoon to come on the podcast. And thanks for attending all the talks and giving us a brief summary. Thanks, everyone. Hope it was fun and exciting. Once again, see you next time.
Thank you very much. It was lovely seeing you today.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues. Enjoyed this episode? You can also find it on Gutflix, the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts, all personalized to your clinical interests. Visit gutflix.eu and start your GI learning experience.